On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Zadie Smith is one of the best writers of her generation. She's smart and funny, and she makes being smart seem really cool. In her new collection of essays, Feel Free, out now, she talks about Jay-Z and Get Out and Facebook and visual artists and classic books and family and Bieber. Yep, Justin Bieber. So I thought I should just email Zadie and say, hey, can we just talk about everything? And she said, yeah. This is a really fun one. Today, Zadie Smith on Touré Show. I've known her almost 20 years. I interviewed her for MTV2 when White Teeth was out. And it's been a thrill to watch Zadie grow and operate as a public intellectual, dropping great novels and dope essays, and showing herself to just be a really interesting person to listen to. I mean, putting the awesomeness of her accent aside, in person, Zadie's as smart and as fun as her greatest books. And she's disarmingly humble in a way that just makes you want to root for her success. So settle in. I asked her to talk to me for an hour, and we sat there for two. We sat there in our studio at 78th and Broadway, and just, this is the most fun episode I've had yet. So I'm proud to present Zadie Smith on Touré Show. So let's talk about writing. What do you love about it?
I like it. I like having an artificial set task to fill the day, set by yourself. It's that's pleasant. I mean, what else are you going to do? It's a long life, and I like the idea of a series of tasks I've set myself, completely unnecessary tasks that nobody has to care about or. But I've set them a series of books in my mind, and then when they're done, I'll be done. I think everyone does that with their life. It's just writing is a very kind of formal way to do it.
Mm.
I can measure out the years this way.
So do you set day goals? Do you set goals?
No, because if I did, I would be very frustrated. So no. But I just have hopes every day. But I haven't written in months and months. You know, at the moment I'm in a period of reading and preparing. But
preparing to start another one.
Yeah. But it's much more important for me to be able to read every day than write every day. I can live without writing. But if I don't get to read, I get very antsy.
Really?
Yeah.
So how many hours a day are you reading?
At the moment, all hours that I'm not raising children.
So you drop them off and you go read until you go pick them up.
And then I lie on a sofa for about 6 hours reading and then I pick them up again.
And then after they're in bed, you read again.
And I read a bit more and I go to sleep. Yeah, that's my life. At the moment, it's not normally like that, but at the moment, that's it, yeah.
What are you reading?
I'm reading a lot of stuff about the 1800s for something I have to write. So it's just a lot of research, I suppose.
Nonfiction.
Nonfiction, yeah, for the most part. Some novels, too. And sometimes I use the bedtime reading with the children as surreptitious research. They don't realize it, but there's a reason we're reading David Copperfield. But they don't need to know that.
What do you love so much about reading?
I read a really good book recently by a guy called Francis Buffett, a British writer, who said that actually it's a kind of addiction. And the strange thing about it is it's a sanctioned addiction. So nobody tells you off for reading a lot when you're a kid, particularly if you're from a working class home or an immigrant home, as I was. Everybody's very enthusiastic about it because it seems like a good sign. But what he said, in his case, he's also a reading addict. He had a very ill sister who died when he was young. And reading for him was a way of escaping the world. And I think that's always basically true. I don't think children who read as much as I did when I was a child are reading because they're delirious with joy about their lives. Mm. It is a kind of addiction. It is a kind of escapism. And you realize it when, like, even to come to this podcast, I've got maybe five heavy books in my bag. What did I imagine was going to happen on the 22-minute subway ride?
What did you bring?
We've got Inside the Victorian Home, a book about a historical 19th century court case, and lots of, I mean, a load of heavy hardback books. So I think reading for me is just the way I am in the world. That's how I operate. And what was interesting about Francis's book is the first time I'd heard it expressed as a kind of personal flaw, you know, because if every spare moment you have, you want to be somewhere else or inside a book, or that is a little problematic, actually. It's not that different from the people who want to get high or want to be on Instagram every moment of the day. It's all about not being where you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess I was raised that way, very focused on being elsewhere.
So when you're in your reading jag, are you bouncing around, or is it just like one book and finish it and then the next
book? That's what I'm trying to do, but then there's all the books, you know, novels and books that aren't to do with work, books by friends, books that are meant to be reviewed, books, I mean, you know this, Pete. So it's a very tall tower of obligatory reading as well. So I kind of mix it all in. I'm happiest when I'm doing that, you know. For me, it's a kind of comforting place to be.
I find myself like, get excited about a book, and inevitably, before I finish it, something else more exciting emerges.
I think this is a common problem these days, right?
Either new or just something that I've discovered, and I must put this aside and read this right now.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
And never can I finish that without, oh my God, I must read this right now. And
I feel that, but I notice now, exactly because of that distraction, which I have feel too, that it's a really great novel when I don't stop, you know. Mm. I don't want to be anywhere else when I'm really inside it and focused on it. I take that as a sign of greatness now, because it is very easy to step aside for a million other things. Yeah.
So you read while you write?
Yeah, sure.
How do you do that, and what are you doing?
If I'm writing a novel, I'm kind of learning or stealing from other people, you know, all the time. And just sometimes, because writing is such a strange ground zero thing, like every time you sit down to write something new, it's entirely possible that you can't write at all. I mean, it's not like piano playing, you know, like a skill which is permanent and you can pass on, or even rapping, or where you know you can do something. Writing, every time you start, it could just be awful. And that can happen at any time. And as we all know from writers we love who write terrible books or terrible essays or terrible stories, that's always a possibility every single time you sit down to write. And for that reason, I think people find it quite stressful to do, me too. But when I'm reading other people's work, part of it is, it can be just schadenfreude, like, oh, this is terrible, and that makes me feel better. Like, oh, well, if he's published and he's awful, so maybe I should, it'll be okay. Or it can go the other way, where something is so wonderful, it kind of inspires you to meet it at its level or try to meet it. And sometimes it's just about reading something that gets you going, that has a kind of rhythm to it, which then transfers into your work, and you're able to write a bit more fluidly that day.
Yeah, I mean, from your description of, I imagine you at the computer, with all these open books around, and it seems like a painter, and I need a little more blue, so I dip into this, but it's like I need a little more of, I don't know what, so I'll read a little of David Foster Wallace.
Right.
Or a little less of this, so read a little. Is it like that?
It is like that, but I do think as you get older, you have to get a little more confident, you know, that you can sit down in front of that blank page and it's not going to be a disaster today. When I was younger, I was a lot more anxious and a lot more in need of textual support from all areas. And sometimes it's just about being in a certain mood. Like when I was writing in Swing Time, I wanted to be kind of surrounded by black culture, you know, one way or another. So it was about books and music and paintings, and I wanted to be in that mind state, you know. And now I'm writing a book which is in England in, you know, 150 years ago, and I want to be in that mind state. It's about being subsumed in something for a while. That's part of the pleasure of doing it, in fact.
I get nervous for performance, live performance.
Right.
I don't get nervous the way you're describing for writing, like, it may turn out bad.
Right.
Because I'm like, we have time. We can edit it 100 more times.
I know.
You know, we have another week or a month, or like, there's time. But when you perform, this is it.
No, that's it. And when I see, like, my brothers are performers, when I see them doing that, I'm glad that I don't do that. but I guess my anxiety is different. It's about being delusional. I think that's what writers are always frightened of, that you've lost the ability to see whatever you're doing clearly, objectively, and as it is. That's always my concern, that I'm writing something that I think is good and in fact it's bad. It's a simple childish anxiety, but it preoccupies me a lot of the time.
I feel like, I guess, like, the esprit d'escalier is what I'm would most be afraid of. And I'm trying to imagine, what will I want to have said
right.
after it's published?
Right.
And can I think of that now?
Right.
So I'm, and like, find a way to like drain myself and like imagine that. And it's hard. It's hard.
It can be hard. And then I guess nowadays there's also the added idea of an instantaneous audience with strong opinions. I also have to try and not think about that when I'm writing.
So,
I'm trying not to think about that, yeah.
So are you in agony while you're going through it?
No. Like, at the moment, but I think most writers would say before the novel starts is a time of great joy, you know, where everything seems possible.
Everything's possible.
Yeah, and it seems like such a beautiful novel in your mind, and you begin it with such high spirits. It definitely gets a little trickier towards the middle, and there is never that sense, like if I see my brother doing stand-up or the times when I used to sing, there are moments in the middle of things like that where you just let go and let instinct take over. Mm. And the more you do that when you sing, the more you do that when you're on a riff in comedy, the better it can be. For me, writing is very rarely like that. The person who's lets go at the typewriter or the laptop and is happily banging away, thinking things are going terrific, that's usually the passage of a novel where you're like, oh, dear God, no. someone should have told you to stop there. It's a different... There's too much consciousness is necessary at all times, you know? You have to be aware and on top, and looseness is hard to achieve in writing, I think. It happens sometimes. There are beautiful moments. Like if you're reading someone like, I don't know, Langston Hughes, there are moments in those poems where I feel this incredible freedom line by line. But my husband's a poet, and I know that even when you read that and you feel it, it's usually been gone over 1,000 times. You know, even what seems natural and fluid is artificial. Writing is kind of an artificial art form.
Artificial in that it pretends to be of one moment, but it's
right,
not.
Right. It seems temporal when you're reading it, like this thing, beautiful, soaring thing is happening in the moment. But as you say, it's been gone over and over and over, and it's calculated in a certain sense to get a reaction out of you, a certain reaction. So it's different than the performing arts, where there's a fluidity, you know, between audience and performer.
I love the tinkering.
Yeah, the tinkering is my favorite bit, for sure. Not the making. My students always talking about creativity and being creative, and that's the part I really hate. It's afterwards. It's the editing, the smoothing out, the perfecting of something.
Yeah,
that's very satisfying, and I love to do it for myself or for anybody else. Anybody wants to send me something to edit, I'm always happy.
Yeah.
Because the only thing you're doing at that point is making something better. Whereas in the creative stage, you have no idea whether you're making it better or worse.
Right.
Anything could be happening there.
No, when I find like those moments, like the 10th edit, the 15th edit, and I'm like, oh, if I remove that sentence,
yeah,
or if I move that graph there,
right,
or this idea is, you know, break it into two, and like, ah, oh, I feel
it's
this
so
release,
better.
And I didn't even know that I was stressed about it.
Yeah, but it's also amazing that you can read something 15 times and not see that obvious
right
cut. That's right. The part which is kind of anxiety-making, because for various reasons, vanity, success, boredom, all kinds of things can make you increasingly blind to that page and that edit, you know?
I remember the novel that I published, which nobody should read. I was in Jamaica. I used to go to Jamaica to Rock House for December.
Oh, lovely.
To finish it. But I didn't have children then. Right. And I didn't have a wife then.
This is just
so I could do that.
Why are we even talking about this right. amazing time?
Right. So, and I finally had it. Like, I had, like, you know, like, three quarters of it written, and I had like an outline for where everything was going, and it was like this one moment I had it like all in mind at once. But it's like really mentally hard to hold right. the entire novel
That's
in your mind at once, and I remember feeling like I have lost my mind,
yeah.
but I will recover this book right. out of it, but I have now right. gone crazy.
I think keeping a whole novel in your mind gets harder and harder. It's easiest for young people, I think. I really, when I think about debut novels, first novels, I see the energy and flexibility of a young mind able to keep the whole thing together. It's no coincidence that older people in their 70s and 80s, the novels get smaller and smaller. You know, they tend to get narrow, somewhat anemic. It is hard to keep all those balls in the air at the same time.
Mm.
But now, this period, like the 40s, 50s, seems to me a very good time for a writer, you know? You still have your brain pretty much, but you also have a little more control. It's a good moment.
Well, the challenge for us as 40 something, soon to be more, is that we have these families.
Yes.
And we both have young children.
Right.
And I mean, I used to get a lot done in the afternoon. And now they're about to come home at 3:30, 4 o'clock, and they're in my hair until 8:30.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'll never get that time back.
No, it'll never come back. But I've been reading a lot of books about Dickens recently, who had 10 children and was very, I'm not saying he was a wonderful father, because he wasn't, but he loved family. He had a kind of fascination with domestic life. And he would write everything pretty much between 7 a.m., 8 a.m., which of course begs the question of who was with the children at that hour. But at about 2 o'clock, he was done. He wanted to see the kids. He wanted to go out for dinner. He wanted to have fun. He was the man who liked life, you know. And when he traveled, he took them all in a crazy caravan, like 5 different carriages to Paris or to Rome, 10 kids, God knows how many nannies, cooks, and everybody came together. So I think it is possible to write in this chaos. And I do think the hours necessary are exaggerated. Like, since I had kids, everything I've written basically between 10 a.m. and 2:30, you know. But that 10 a.m. and 2:30 has to be then really undisturbed, like no email, no internet. That's a lot of hours, in fact, if you're not doing anything else.
So this is one of the things that you have talked about that really moves me positively and negatively, when you talk about protecting your writing time.
Yes.
And How do you do that?
But only when they're in school. Like the previous idea, like when I went to college, I met a lot of people who were the children of so-called creative people, artists, writers. And the stories they told, and these are stories from the 70s and 80s, were completely horrifying to me.
Yes.
You know, these like grandiose assholes who would tell their children to their faces, look, I'm making great art in here. Don't come in here at any hour ever.
Yes.
And they were proud of it. You know, they really thought they'd achieved something extraordinary. And of course, when I met their children hated them with a million sons and had rebelled in every single way and were disgusted by it. And also the art that they created was not that great. You know, it was self-aggrandizing, totally self-focused. But there was certainly a lot of it. And I think there's no doubt that if you protect your time from everybody and from life itself, you will write those 28 novels or more, and maybe you'll win all those prizes. But for me, it's not about mothering versus writing. It's about life versus writing. And I do have quite not as much hunger as Dickens, but I like life, you know?
Yeah.
I want to be in it and to live it. And I used to think, oh, if only I had all day long to write and read. But that life is a barren one, the way I would do it.
Yeah.
it would be something you wouldn't want to live, actually. So I'm glad I've been rescued from it.
You talk about, I think of this all the time, writing on a computer that's not connected to the internet, or distancing yourself from the internet for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
And I find it impossible to do because there's always something I got to check,
right.
Some idea I got to play out, and inevitably you go down a rabbit hole and you're like, I did 30 minutes doing this.
This is my advice. I mean, it's not everybody can do whatever they want to do, but if you check this process you're talking about, there's email. I know there's email and there's things you need to Google. But if you just made a little note of all those things and didn't check them till, say, 5 o'clock, you would do all that checking in 20 minutes. It would take you 20 minutes to go through your email and Google whatever it was. If you do it all the way through the day, you might lose 3.5 hours. Because what's Cardi B doing? And then something, blah, 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 and Kendrick and somebody. That's 3.5 hours. What? So it's up to you. Like, what do you want to do with your time?
How about, what is this word that I'm choosing really mean? And is it really the right word for this
space? It's annoying. I bracket it and I think, I really wish I could go online and check it right now. But it's worth it for me just to hold it there and come back in 4 hours and just check it.
See,
in what will be a 30-second operation instead of a day-long Google hole.
So you're just that disciplined.
No, it's not discipline. It's just necessity because I don't have time to waste.
Yeah.
I just don't have it.
I want to get more granular. What is the difference between a good sentence and a great sentence?
For me, a good sentence will do. The problem is between good sentences and terrible sentences, which are everywhere. So a lot of what's going on in the moment, even at quite high levels, is just mistaken usage. Like, my students laugh at me when I say, you know, most of what we'll be doing 14 weeks is just really correcting grammar and vocabulary, because they consider themselves, and they are brilliant young people, but something is going wrong in the schools, or so I don't know what's going on, but people are not using language correctly. It's way beyond, are you using it in a beautiful way or a flowery or interesting way? I'm only interested in correct. If it were correct, you've already scaled Everest as far as I'm concerned. I saw it, like, one of my publishers sent me a thing about this new book, and it was on like a very respectable website, and it was a little short review, and it said, Sadie Smith, who's gathered so much opprobrium throughout her career, but that word means, you know, disgust and hatred, and they thought it meant it's people literally using the wrong words to describe what they need to describe. That's really a problem for me.
But you're kind of getting at something that I've tried to do, or I've noticed myself doing, because when I got out of graduate school, I thought, if I just write beautiful sentences, the world will rush to my books and everything will work out. And after a couple of years, I realized nobody wants the beautiful sentences. Yeah. And when I got down to stop paying attention to the structure and the architecture and the prettiness of the sentence, and just how can I directly communicate these ideas,
right,
and get down to like the nub of the truth of the idea.
Truth, that's what people are urgently in need of.
That's the thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Truth in itself is beautiful, to quote a very old idea. And clarity is beautiful. Elaborate sentences can also be beautiful, but without a sense of an urgency that you're really trying to convey something other than just their beauty. There's not much use in them.
So if all the words are used correctly.
Yes. And then something is risked. I don't think there's any point in writing if you're not risking something. The most obvious kind, I guess, today is revelation. People think the point of writing is to reveal something about themselves, maybe something hidden. That can be true, but there are other kinds of risks you can take. When you're really, really trying to tell the truth about something, it usually doesn't look too pretty on you. You know, the real truth is usually quite hard to tell and doesn't often put you in the best light. And that kind of writing interests me. Writing that dares to be, to say what it thinks, even in the face of a mass opinion on the other side. A writing that tries to get to the core of something without being swayed by fashion or even important things like community. It's very hard to write opposite community. You know, community seems such a wonderful thing and you want to be a part of a community, but everybody can feel a part of something and also have that section of themselves which disagrees.
Yeah.
And to express that disagreement can be hard.
To challenge the community. Right. I feel differently.
Right, right. To feel differently.
When I was growing up, it meant so much to hear black voices like James Baldwin and Toni Morrison talk about the black experience, because black stories matter. The next generation of influential black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today. From The Wire to Bobby Shmurda, from Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range on Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives have not usually been centered in the telling of American stories. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the black experience. Turn on NPR today and hear real black stories, because stories should never be told about us without us being in them. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham. A keenly observed novel about a young black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
Yeah, it's there seems to be no shortage of people who will say, I feel opposite all of you.
Yeah, to, but that's not quite the same thing.
Right, to make a name.
Yeah, and it's usually a kind of self-aggrandizing thing, as if your opinion is a valuable thing in itself. I don't really feel that way.
you don't feel that way?
No, I don't.
You have like, I mean, I mean, you are so humble. And you've always been so humble, but I mean, like, you do have like the world saying, "Hey, we are curious in your opinion on any number of things."
But for me, they have to be. It's a difference between taking positions which are like something that accrues to you, as if I wear this great dress, I have these great shoes, I have these great opinions. That's not what interests me. I'm interested in hearing people think about something. Really think it through, really discuss it. Yeah. But I'm not, if you have a selection of the right opinions or the wrong opinions, I they're not commodities, you know? That's not something that concerns me.
Mm.
So,
Well, nobody has. Nobody's like, well, he's always right. Like, you know, you're right and you're wrong. And
but there is a sense of establishing your identity through agreement or disagreement, just by in any way relating to this mass, this group. And I when I'm trying to think about something, I'm just trying to think, what is it I really think, independently of what anybody else is saying? Yeah. What is it I really think? Yeah. And what does it mean that I think that? And do I think it because I want to think it? Is it wishful thinking? Am I getting some advantage out of it? You have to interrogate whatever you think a few times over.
What else is so you want to go good, bad, not good to great. So what else is the difference between beyond being correct, beyond risking something, the difference between good and bad writing in general?
I do think, like, when I'm emailing, if you have a wide series of email acquaintances, you might notice that there are certain people, they could be doing any job in the world. It could be your old aunt or who just, they're the emails you immediately want to read. That's called having a voice, and that's strange. It happens all over the place to non-writers, to all kinds of people. I'm always very curious about it. I open my email and I think, oh, there's someone I want to open first because the way they email, I want to read that. And there are other people who you'd rather die than read their email, but you know sooner or later you're going to have to read the 7 paragraphs with the ellipsis and the, you know what it's going to be like. So that interests me, that there is an innate gift for clarity in certain people who might never even consider themselves writers in a million years, but they have something there.
Yeah.
When they write, it's direct. You understand them and you feel the force of their personality behind it. So that's the part I think that's hard to... hard to teach, but I like to see that, and a voice, I suppose.
My son wrote something, some little thing for school, and it really had a voice,
right?
And it had his voice, and right. He's a 10-year-old boy, so it was slightly obnoxious. But I'm like, there's a voice here,
that's
like this is amazing that
that's
it like really leaps off the page and it sounds like you,
right.
And like. I don't know if I agree with the point you're making, but I love the way that you've constructed it. And I was like, I don't know how you did that or how I can say, here's where it becomes voicey.
But I think there's the various kind of blockades people put between them and the writing are gone. Like when someone sits down to write, if they're self-conscious, they'll use a high register, or if they want to impress someone, they'll say something which isn't quite true, but in a certain form. And or they'll use language which is shop-worn, old language of adverts, bad movies, sentimental cards. If you remove all that, then you have something. Mm. And it's just that some people remove it very naturally. They don't even think about all these various constructions that can be put on writing.
I mean, this is...
Kids particularly.
This is the core of it, finding the right word.
Right.
Is the core of it.
Right, and sometimes it can be incredibly important. Like in political arguments, you know, you can say so-and-so is the accuser, that's one thing, but if you call them the victim, then you're in a whole other moral argument almost immediately, no?
Versus survivor.
Right, so these things are not neutral. It's incredibly important which word you choose, how you choose it, and to be aware of all the ramifications which come with that word.
Well, sure. And to use a word that borrows too much from another language,
right.
Takes you away.
Right.
Are all the other words
right.
Latin-based or, you know, traditional right. English? And I find myself almost taking out each word and going, is this the right word? Can I have another word? Okay, that one seems fine. What about this one, right?
And right. Like, so then imagine, to me, thinking of hip-hop is doing all of what we've just been talking about and then also making it rhyme.
Right.
And then also doing it like 20
right.
syllables
right.
a line. And then also having an incredible beat behind you and making people want to dance. To me, it's like opera in that it's a total art form using so many different skills simultaneously.
I mean, we've seen hip-hop go from... quite often external, right?
Right.
The ghetto reporter thing,
right.
To almost always I.
Yes.
And it's a fake I usually,
right.
But like
many eyes, multiple eyes.
Right. That it's like it's almost entirely I did this, I did that.
Or in a case with someone like Kendrick, it's become a fully established like world. You can talk about Kendrick world, in which there are multiple voices operating and all kinds of different perspectives, personal, social, ghetto reporter, historian, and that's a kind of new scale. It's like 15 rappers in one man.
Do you like Kanye?
I do. I love Kanye. Matter of constant argument in our house.
Your husband doesn't like him.
No. I totally understand all objections to Kanye as a person.
Are they?
As an entity. But I was talking to my friend Dev Hines. Do you know that guy, Blood Orange?
Yeah, I do.
And we were talking about... I really am so uninterested in the Kanye as phenomenon and his wife and all that. I couldn't care less. But if you just talk about the albums... It's an unbroken run of masterpieces.
It is.
That's all I'm concerned with.
It really is.
Everything else about him, I can't explain. I can't explain any of his public utterances, his politics, his attitudes to women. I don't understand any of it. But if you're talking about those albums, there's nothing like it in popular music.
I think
it's unprecedented. You have to talk about Stevie Wonder to find someone with that many.
It's like Stevie Wonder and Paul Simon.
Right.
Like the first five albums are extraordinary.
But they're all extraordinary. Even the ones where I used to think, I'm not sure, and they're all extraordinary. So I think you could talk about Idiot Savant, but I don't think that's it. I think he's a man with an extraordinary genius in this area, and I don't understand why that isn't enough. I don't need people to be upstanding citizens as well as artistic geniuses. I don't care. I don't ask that of Picasso. I don't mind.
Yeah.
I would go to the mat for those albums. Anybody who loves rap would seize their greatness, and the rest of it is the rest of it. It doesn't bother me really.
Yeah, yeah. The last album I loved a lot, but the experimenting or tweaking the songs after they were released thing became very strange to me because I loved the songs in a certain way.
Yeah.
And usually the tweaks would make me like them less.
Yes. It's an excess of energy. I mean, it's also the medium to be allowed to be able to tweak in that way. I think there's many a novelist who would like to take the book back off the shelf and do another edit, another run through.
Of course.
I think it's a mistake. I think in the end, the album you create is the album you create, and I want to spend time in there. But to me, the last one is completely sublime and extraordinarily beautiful.
Yeah.
So I suppose I experienced it, like, if you saw that Arthur Jaffa, did you see that?
Which one?
Arthur Jaffa, the artist, he used ultralight beam in various parts of that show. And I was listening to the album while also seeing Kerry Marshall or Lynette Yadambourakis. It seemed to me all of this, a certain moment of kind of sublime black excellence, to use Jay-Z's phrase.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was a wonderful moment anyway. It feels a long way away now.
I mean, you talk about that. I mean, I think about television. It's an extraordinary moment for black television.
Right.
You probably don't
watch. I was also watching Insecure around the same time as well.
Well, I mean, there's only like 10 great shows starring black people, you know, many created by black people. It's a really extraordinary moment.
If you compare it to our childhood, it's unbelievable. It's really unbelievable. It's a great time.
And you write about Get Out in your new book.
Yes. Yeah. I had some interest in Jordan before because I'd gone to see him and Key and Peele in LA. I loved the movie and I loved writing about it. It was really enjoyable. And Jordan is amazing to me.
It's just an extraordinary, metaphor and just discussion of like race and this.
I know, it's so strange now that it barely feels like a movie anymore. I actually can't really imagine watching it again. It's become so embedded in the culture that it's like a monument
it's
that
like
you
the,
walk around and admire. But but that's incredible that should be true.
It's like The Matrix,
right?
Just subsumed into the collective memory.
It's a really incredible thing.
Even if you haven't seen Get Out or The Sunken Place,
right.
You know what that means.
And it's amazing news for everybody else because what it proves is that that movie did not cost a lot of money.
Mm.
You just need ideas. And comedy's always been like that. Comedy movies cost little and make enormous money. But Jordan has all the gifts. I mean, so funny, so smart, so much imagination. So it's just the beginning, I'm sure, for him.
dance lessons for writers.
Yes.
What do we as writers learn from Prince and Michael Jackson?
Well, when I was writing about it, I have a long time fixation on Jackson for, I don't know. I was born in 1975. That's just what happened if you were born then.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And like all kids of my generation, I learned those dances and loved to do them. And
Did you guys get the cartoon over there?
Yeah, we got everything.
Oh, God, that was the best.
But I'm a far bigger Prince fan, you know, in terms of
yes.
the music and the man and the art. But it doesn't change the fact that when I had children, I showed them these Jackson videos. I was interested in the legibility of Michael Jackson. In order to be that famous, that successful, that remembered, there's something that has to be completely open and readable in you, you know, in all your movements. And Michael Jackson is that kind of dancer. He is a popular artist of the first order. And I never sneer at popular art. I've always loved it my whole life. But Prince is an example of something other, no? Somebody who is, even though he's in full view and just as famous as Jackson probably, is somehow hidden, you know. Not everything is exposed to you. Both the music and the dancing feel like a strange secret that you and he know. And so whenever you go to a Prince concert, as I did maybe 12 times, you could be in a stadium and you'd be like, who are all these other? Who the fuck are these people? It's meant to be just you and me having this moment. And you realize that this very intimate experience you've had has been shared by millions. Jackson was never like that. Jackson's like having a Coca-Cola. You know that everybody on the planet is having one.
Yeah. No, that's true.
Right.
That's true. It did feel like this intimate connection with Prince. Right. And that went back from...
Always. It never went.
I think I was too young to really know what like sexuality was when right. Purple Rain came out, but we had a sense of it.
Right.
And I remember feeling like, my sister is way too much into this album.
Right.
Like, I love this album, but she loves it on a different level. Like, what's going on there?
I mean, all the teenage girls I knew were obsessed with him. It was an offering of a kind of sexuality you couldn't find anywhere else, you know, that was interested in you, but also on your side, you know.
Yeah.
It was likely to do your mascara and then do his mascara, and then you both go out on the town.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a beautiful vision in 1987.
I always thought that women wanted, you know, like, tough guys, not like,
well, maybe they thought so too,
together.
But he brought some news.
He brought some news. Can you do things as a writer now that you couldn't do before, like, say, when you were doing White Teeth?
That's a good question. I think my flow's a little better. I'm much less eager to please, and that frees you up in different ways, you know? Be a little bit braver, a little bit bolder sometimes. But then, conversely, there are things I did, I think, when I was young that I can't do anymore. So you lose stuff too.
Like what?
I think I wrote, I'm not, I haven't read that book in so long, but my memory of it is that it's funny. It's funny. And part of its funniness is treating everybody like more or less a joke, you know?
Mm.
And I can't do that anymore.
Mm.
Life gets too hard and too painful.
Mm.
And I can't laugh. I really admire lifelong satirists and how they keep it up. But the objects of laughter in White Teeth, to me, would not be funny. I wouldn't be able to laugh at them in the same way or resist from saying, well, yes, I know she's ridiculous, but what about this?
Mm.
You know, you start wanting to make more of a case for people and to make them human. And the joke relies on them not being too human, you know?
When you talk about being braver, what do you mean?
You know, when you're young, your sense of yourself is important. You're trying to convey something or pitch something to other people, lovers, friends, or public if you have one. As you get older, as all old people will tell you, it becomes less important, you know? You just want to live in truth and feel truth and be honest, even if it doesn't look so pretty, you know? I think that can make you braver. There's nothing more anxious than a 23-year-old girl, you know, in a certain sense. She's so worried about everything, what everyone thinks about her, what she can say. Older women, if you see a group of, like, yeah. black women in their 60s on holiday together, they couldn't give a shit about anything.
Yeah.
It's real freedom. I see it in my mother. She's way beyond anything like that. Yeah. She couldn't care what you think, what anybody thinks. She's just out for fun now. And I think it does make you bold.
So what do you, I mean, I understand where you're talking about risk in a nonfiction context.
Right.
But in a fictional context where you make up the game, what?
Absolutely. And novels are always like that. That's a really good point. You make up the game. There's something annoying about novels for that reason. I always feel annoyed when I'm reading a novel because the whole thing's been set up.
Yeah.
And it's all rigged.
But and I don't mean that in any negative way. Native Son comes to mind as an extremely brave book, right? So what does that mean for a novelist?
I think of something like Giovanni's Room. This is a really good example. Baldwin, when he wrote that book, he could have gone many different ways and pleased many more people, you know? He could have written a kind of black power Afrocentric novel and pleased a lot of people. He could have written a gay novel and pleased less people, but a particular audience. Mm. He could have written Another Country Again and got those white liberals on board. Instead, he wrote a book almost calculated to annoy every single person he knew, everyone in his constituency, his publishers, his gay friends, his white friends, his black friends, everybody hated that book and told him not to publish it, warned him not to publish it. Now it's beloved, you know, but people often forget how hard it is to get to beloved, you know. That book was despised and he was despised. It took enormous guts to write that book exactly because he had no hope of it being welcomed. That's the kind of risk you take. Even in that case, people often forget, I realize sometimes when I'm talking about it with people forget the narrator is a white guy. It's Baldwin saying, I, but it's a white guy in that novel. He put himself in the opposite position and tried to imagine what that was like, and nobody wanted to read that book either. Now they read it. So those kind of risks that are against the grain of the political moment, against even the advice of friends, but have an urgency in them. He needed to write that book. He wanted to imagine what it was like to be a white, gay, American guy in Paris. He was interested in that perspective. He was interested in the perspective of everybody else in that novel. But he wanted to be in all those places against everybody's better advice. And I'm so grateful that book exists because it's an example of what you can do when you don't give a fuck, as the rappers.
So part of it, you talk about aesthetic risks.
Aesthetic risks. Sometimes they're political. They're all different kinds. They can be about voice, style, character. They can be many different kinds, but if there isn't something new in a novel, I remember reading Kurt Sears saying this somewhere as a young man in some journal. He was saying it to Paul Auster, slightly furtively, because he doesn't know if Auster will agree, but he says, you know, maybe I'm a snob, but as far as I'm concerned, if there isn't something new in a novel at some level, could be structural, could be stylistic, then why have you written it? And I think that's fair enough. It's a high standard, but I don't see any other one you can apply.
So if I'm 25, 30, trying to get better as a novelist, maybe I wrote one, but what do you want me to read? What do you want me to read to get better as a writer?
I think the main thing is not to limit yourself in your reading, to read everything. That was the thing my mother impressed on me, and it was such good advice, even though I kind of resisted it at the time, you know. At various points when I was a kid, I had moments of assimilation where I wanted to read all English literature because I wanted to be, you know, English like everybody else and normal, like any other kid wants to be normal. Then I had other times of wanting to entirely read black American writing and want to read anything else, and want to hear about anything else. My mother was always insistent on the idea that, which she took from Baldwin, it's Baldwin's argument, that the world is yours. Baldwin said, you know, all of black writing is mine, but Bach is also mine. If I'm a human, then all culture made by all humans is mine. Mine to take, mine to ingest, and mine to use. That was my mother's principle, and sometimes I thought it was apolitical or strange, but I think she was right, and it was a very good habit that she brought to me, because in our shelves there was something of everything, you know. And even writers who we personally... she found painful, like she had a lot of Naipaul, and for a Jamaican, having Naipaul on your shelves is not easy because there's a lot in those books which is directly offensive and cruel. But my mother's opinion was, this is a Caribbean writer. We are Caribbean. He's one of the great Caribbean writers. You're going to read him. And if you find something in there you don't approve of or that is offensive, and there is plenty, you're strong. Mm. Read it, move on to the next page.
Okay, so can you give advice for younger folks? Writing
advice. The first advice is do you really want to do this in terms of as a life practice? Because one of the main parts of writing is the willingness to be alone for most of the day, for almost all of the day.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that suits a lot of people, understandably, because it's really boring. And you can have the same gifts. Like, I think of both my brothers, I would say we all have exactly the same gift, which at root is imitation. We can do voices, we can copy sounds and sing like other people or rap like other people. It's just imitation. We're like imitators. It's the same gift, if that's what you want to call it, but we've put it to different uses. My brother likes people and company, so he's a stand-up, an actor. He works with people. That's what he does all day long. My little brother is a rapper. He wants to be around people. He writes songs. He's collaborative. I want to be alone a lot of the time. And the art I've chosen is for that. And so whenever I'm speaking to young writers, speaking to my students, that's the first question I ask. Is this what you want to do all day?
To be alone.
To be alone and fall back on yourself without interruption for 6-8 hours a day, because a lot of people don't. If the answer is yes to that part, then to me it is about taking in culture, art, books, music, film, everything, and of course living as much as you can, as honestly as you can, outside of collective movements, dogma, shared ideas, just trying to live your own life.
You read Zora Neale Hurston as a younger person, talking about black women as the mule of the world.
Yeah.
And it had a negative experience, negative impact on you. What was that experience?
Because I knew it was true, looking at the history of my family. I knew it was true. But I didn't, I wanted to break it. And I knew my mother wanted to break it for me, you know. It's different now because I don't fear it anymore. But I mean, my brother told me, I didn't go on this trip, but they all went back to Jamaica last year. I couldn't go. And my mum was insistent on taking my brother and his kids to see where she grew up. And she was trying to find it. My family are real country people. So they got to the village and they started trying to get through the bush. And everyone was getting tired and hot and saying, Mum, you know, I don't think we're going to find it. It was a long time ago. And she was completely insistent. They're going through the literal bush, and then they found this broken-down shack. It's a shack. And my mother said, this is the place.
Wow.
And my brother reported it to me. And I knew the stories, like, you know, 8 kids in a bed and no parents because the parents left for England, you know, so you're being brought up by a grandmother. But my brother said when he saw it, it's a lot to take on, you know. You have to do a lot of forgiveness because you realize, however harsh your own mother has been, there was a reason, you know. She was trying to get away from something, try to change something. Mm. Wasn't easy. It's not easy to be a fatherless child and a motherless child, which is a long history in Jamaica, at least, you know, in my family. Going back a long way, there's all these motherless and fatherless children. So I guess when I was a kid, I wanted to respect that past, but I didn't want to be contained by it. You know, I was scared of it to a certain degree. And when Zora said that thing, I thought, yes, that's been true of the women in my family going back generations, but it's not going to be true of me, you know. And it already wasn't true of my mother because she was so determined. But I was scared of it, and so I ran from it. And then when I returned to it, I just realized that it was a great source of strength, you know, of course. It's so obvious now, but suffering is not something to be run away from. And communities who have experienced great amounts of suffering, have all this beauty, all this power that I just had to tap into, you know. That's what Zora did. Her writing is full of all that history. It doesn't run from it, doesn't shy from it. but it's also flowering in glory and beauty and music. And so it's just a double gift, you know. Every kid feels that. It's like, are you, in any circumstance, I'm sure, that you can tell me about the pain. You can tell me about all the pain and you want to get out from under it. But then you come back. You come back and see also what a glorious history it is.
I mean, I know you, but I don't know your entire life.
Right.
Have you entirely escaped it?
But I didn't want to. I was writing recently about a photographer, Deanna Lawson, a wonderful African-American photographer from Rochester who takes pictures of diaspora folk all over the world. Jamaica, Haiti, Bronxville, Yonkers, wherever she is, she takes these extraordinary pictures, usually in their living rooms. Often they're undressed, these people. One of them's, in fact, on the cover of one of Dev's albums. And because of the nature of diaspora, a lot of these pictures are pictures of poverty, one way or another, because a diaspora is deeply embedded in poverty all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of our distinguishing characteristics for various obvious historical social reasons. So when you're looking at these photos, which are incredibly beautiful, and they really are of kings and queens, you know, in these debased circumstances, if you were to run from it, what are you running from? Of course, everyone wants to run from poverty, but do you want to run from blackness simultaneously? No.
Hmm.
So that's the part I find problematic, you know. To say you've escaped is to say you've escaped your people, your community, your background. That's not something I want to escape. Do you want to untie the binds between a community and poverty? Of course. You know, you want that to be historically no longer true. But it's been a long time coming.
Mm.
And, I mean, one of the things I found when I came to America, which is completely different from an African-American perspective, I know, but I'd never come across such a large black middle class. I didn't know that existed, you know.
Right.
To me, America, that was the revelation to me that there's something in between being, you know, dirt poor as my mother's family was, and then, you know, getting by when you get to the second country. There's a whole history here.
Yeah.
Which I just was not familiar with, and that to me, I had a lot of delight in that, you know. Though I know it's completely different from the perspective, you know, of someone like Ta-Nehisi, or who's lived here all his life, generations here. But for me, coming here, the fact of Ta-Nehisi, for example, was amazing.
Yeah.
That there were, you know, black intellectuals, black artists in every corner doing extraordinary work. All those people exist in England, but it's hard to break through, you know. The country is resistant to the idea. And to be here and to feel it has at least some history, that was important to me. And I think for all black children in Europe, America is that place, you know, where the music came from, where the books come from, where the films come from. You look that way. So to be here for me was a great kind of rejuvenation.
When did you come here? What year?
I came first just after 2001. I came to do the novel first, White Teeth, in 2000, on a long book tour. And then I was in and out from kind of 2002 onwards.
You describe America purely within this context of what you were just saying.
Right.
Purely as like so inspiring because I meet figuratively all these amazing black people and I see what's possible. And that is real.
Yeah, but then it's simultaneously a nightmare.
Yeah, and especially since 01, there's been so much.
But that's it. America is this extraordinary mixed reality. It always has been. From the very seeds of it, the ideas of democracy and slavery happen in a coeval manner. They happen together. It's the kind of thing which will drive you out of your mind. And there's no small proportion of black artists, black intellectuals in this country who have been driven literally out of their minds. I always think of Nina Simone. Nina Simone was, I believe, driven mad by America, mentally ill by living in this country. So I see that side every day. And yet still there is the fact of Nina Simone.
And someone like Nina and others who get to a crossroad where you can speak your truth or have a career, but you can't have both.
No.
And especially when you are an artist, some level of activist, parent, you can't choose just close your eyes.
Her life was impossible. And yet she tried to live it, you know? She tried to be a good mother. She tried to be an artist. She tried to be an activist. She tried to find somewhere to live where she could breathe. She went to Liberia. She tried everything. but this country would not, I mean, they would not let her live.
And she was dealing with domestic violence before that was a term. No. She was bipolar before that was a term.
It's it was an impossible life. And yet, you know, there's this incredible body of work. So, no, I don't downplay the horror here, but I just am aware from my perspective that I experienced a lot of joy being here just because it was so new to me.
Nina Simone to me is the greatest singer ever.
Yes, this me and my husband agree on.
How there's no gap. Me feel, yeah. Right? I mean, the depth of what she's able to make me feel is so powerful.
No, she's incredible, and Nick is the biggest Nina fan ever. I always loved Nina, but I didn't know her the way he knows her, and so since we've been married, I think I've heard every single thing she ever recorded. And also the way it weaves into Kanye's work is so wonderful. It comes back over and over and over. He uses her so many times.
Mm-hmm.
He is some kind of almost funhouse mirror version of her in that his life is impossible. But I mean, he's made it impossible in various ways himself.
Yeah.
But I see what he's aligning to, this sense of an impossible identity, this daily struggle. Even though, and I can see why outrageous people, when he uses those Nina tracks, she's talking about struggle and he's talking about, you know, they won't let me wear jeggings in wherever, you know, it's absurd. But structurally, it works musically. I understand the kind of connection he makes. But yes, her voice, maybe for me, Billie Holiday slightly edges her out, but that's entirely personal. Something about Billie does it for me.
And Billie has that same, like, will slice through your heart.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And I when I think about all this advice about writing, one of the main ones, like when I wanted to sing, one of the things which stopped me singing definitively were singers like that. I just thought, on the same principle, if you can't make it new, why would you want to be just a club singer with a nice voice doing impersonations of great artists? I couldn't stand it. So I think when you're choosing an art form, you're choosing the one that you think you can exist in, that you have there's a space for you.
My God.
You can maybe do a little thing which is new.
If you tell that to young writers, they'll all leave.
I don't know, man. You have to have that. You have to aim high. I love to sing, but if you can't sing, like, if you're not an artist, why bother?
I mean, if you're a writer, you will always be number two. You can't get above Shakespeare.
No.
There's no chance.
But you can make your little. It's like I've heard a beautiful metaphor for it recently, from some writer who I now can't remember, a dead writer, an old writer, but about the idea of writing being a massive lake.
Yeah.
Into which these tributaries feed.
Yeah.
And the tributaries are everywhere. And you can be one of these tiny little tributaries feeding this lake called literature.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
And I always found that much more possible than music, where I just personally was overwhelmed by genius. But I don't feel that in writing for some reason.
But even as a black writer, you'll always be behind Invisible Man.
Yeah. There's no... But I feel fine about... I like being part of that lake.
Okay.
I don't know why in music I couldn't believe in the lake. In music, all I could see was Stevie Wonder. And that just depressed the hell out of me.
And I can't compete with
no,
that.
No
so
point.
Don't bother singing.
There's no point.
He's not even, I mean,
But there should be actually someone else who could make a very good argument for the idea of the amateur, the joy of amateurism, the joy of just participating in art because it's beautiful and pleasurable. I think that's definitely true too.
Yeah. I mean, is more
fun? There's nothing
fun.
Wrong with that. And actually, recently in my 40s, I've begun singing a little bit just because
nice.
I really didn't sing for 20 years and remembering, well, this, it's not just about, you know, making your place. There's also just the joy of the practice of playing an instrument, of singing.
What kind of singer are you?
I'm just an impersonator. I'm an impersonator. I can do various people.
Like what? Can you do Billy?
I can do a good Ella. I'm not bad at Billy.
Give me a Billy.
No, I'm not singing anything on this record.
Give me an Ella.
No. But bar. No way. But that's what I used to do. I did a good Sinatra when I was a teenager for some reason. I used to do a lot of Sinatra. So crooning, I guess, is what I do. Yeah. Bad crooning. Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's like sometimes I feel like, we cheated the whole game because we like make it by writing. I just sit there picking words and moving around. Oh, and
what
like,
an incredible privilege.
Yes.
Like yes. It's incredible luck.
Yes. No, we don't have to do actual, I mean, it's hard, but there are way harder ways.
I mean, my mother just retired after 35 years of social work and child therapy, and that's work.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's work that kind of emotionally breaks you down over the years, you know? You're dealing with other people's pain directly, not imaginary people, real people, every day. I do find writing hard, but I am regularly blissed out at the idea that it's my practice, you know, that I get to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think about all the history that you know. Who do you see as sort of kindred spirit? Like, do you see yourself in Billie or Billie Holiday or Zora or, I don't know who, Marcus Garvey, I don't know who.
It's people who inspired you. There's something, and I'm, so many black women writers will say exactly the same thing, but something in Zora, she's quite ornery, you know, she's very perverse and bad tempered a lot of the time, which amuses me. She's not easy. That's what you would say about her. She's not an easy person. And I kind of like that about her. Toni Morrison, also not an easy person. I like the idea of a black woman who stands in her own space and is not always seeking approval from everybody, you know? When I read Toni Morrison interviews these days, I just feel there's someone who completed her tasks. Like, if you're talking about success, to me that's what it really means. Not winning a Nobel Prize, although I'm sure that's wonderful, but she wrote the books she wanted to write. She completed them. They were great. She decided on her project. She finished it. And she was not distracted by anybody or anything. And to me that is success, you know?
You mentioned that a couple of times, this notion of not needing external approval and just doing what you want to do. That's the big freedom for you.
I think that because I grew up in a family of hams, you know, we're always looking for approval, singing, dancing, acting, trying to get some applause. And I think I was talking to my brother recently, he'd come off a long stand-up tour and now he's in some TV show. And I am aware of our childhood preoccupation with applause, and I'm also aware at our age now that it's just not about that anymore, and that part of getting mentally healthy for both me and my brothers is realizing that there's no amount of clapping that is going to make you feel like a happy person. That's not going to work. I think all stand-ups work that out in the end, right? Like Chris Rock, Chappelle, like you're not skipping in the bushes because everybody clapped for you. I don't think that works in the end. I think you need to find a firmer basis for your happiness than that.
Do you?
Really? I think so. I think personally.
I mean.
I think so, and I think it's in relations with others. Like, obvious examples: your children, your partner. But it's you know that silly line from I can't believe I'm going to quote this, but from It's a Wonderful Life, where it says, "No man is a failure who has friends." This is the bottom line, you know. Genuine relations with other human beings before you die, that's success. And it's lovely to do good work and feel rewarded for it, but strangers applauding you, to me it's like a cocaine or something. It feels good for a few hours and then it really doesn't.
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
Right.
I mean, it is like cocaine in that it does jolt you up and you have an endless need for more.
But at a certain point you go beyond it. And the greatest artists, like I just watched that Chappelle thing. And I can see with Chappelle that, you know, when a comedian starts out, even when Chappelle started out, it's the laughter you need. Yeah. So you need it every 20 seconds, sometimes much less than that. And it has to be continuous. And there are various points in Chappelle's show, and it happens to all great comedians, really great, where the laughter stops because he's not saying anything funny.
Right.
He's telling you the history of black people in America,
right,
which lasted, it was like 9 minutes or something of total silence. In the end, comedians, they become contemptuous of laughter because if people are laughing everywhere you expect them to laugh, it's not funny to you anymore. Well, and you start hating them for it as well.
Well, then you're a clown.
And you're a clown. And Chappelle is no clown. And I think what you, as you get older, what you really want to do is make yourself clear and say what you want to say. And those passages in his stand-up, the historical passages, the bit about Emmett Till, to me, were sublime. I don't know if you call them comedy. Whatever you call that is great and makes him great.
His Bill Cosby joke from the, was like a year ago, is so amazing.
Right.
And to retell it would take about 20 minutes.
Right.
You know, it starts in this place you don't even see it coming, that it's going to, and it's so well constructed and it's so beautiful.
It's extraordinary. I think at that point, and with Rock 2, you're dealing with something like West African storytelling, actually. They're like griots. They're telling very long tales that the whole village is coming to listen to. And it's an ancient tradition, and it's awesome to see.
I mean, I feel Chappelle has, and at one time this would have been sacrilegious, but I feel like Chappelle has long gone past Rock in terms of being able to do stand-up. just
no comment.
I mean, it's just so...
It's different.
It's so...
Chris Rock still, he'll make you cry with laughter.
But
and
Dave,
that's a very important part of comedy. You shouldn't forget that part.
No, it is. Dave is talking so much about himself. And Chris talks about, in Chris's new one, he talks about himself, and it's very powerful.
Yeah, there's a divorce tour going on, isn't there?
Oh, yes. The divorce stuff is very painful. And it's like, you're not laughing for a good 10 minutes.
Right.
But, Chappelle, my God. I mean, it's become so special, the work that he's, when it's working.
It's amazing.
It's working.
I think the good thing is, like, whenever you have great artists like Kanye and Kendrick working simultaneously, it's fun for everybody.
Yeah.
The competition is healthy and interesting. And I'm always saying to my kids, they always want to know who's better. Like, whatever we're doing, if we're watching a musical, if we're listening to it, who's better? Is it him or her? Because I guess they hear me and Nick constantly giving these bloody judgments of various books, movies. So they've become like little critics in their mind. But when they put it so boldly, the way children do, I'm ashamed of it. You know, I'm ashamed of the instinct. So I always say, no, it's not about, is Judy Garland better than Barbara Streisand? These are different ways of being in the world. And that's truly how I feel most of the time. That when you're invested in an artist, you're in the stream of their style, of their way of being. And to be with Rock is completely different than being with Chappelle. It's a different feeling, both personally, if you've met them both, and also if you're listening to them do stand-up. It's a different way of being, and you just have to be grateful for the variety and the quality of these different demonstrations.
There was a time when we thought about Chappelle's work ethic. Like, what's up with that guy? He hasn't done anything in ages. And now he's done 4 hours in, like, 2 years.
Right.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And you know how hard it is to work up that material and deliver it at that level. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very happy story, because there were maybe moments where you thought America was about to drive Chappelle mad the way it drove Nina mad, but no.
Yeah, yeah, and he talked about that. I talked to him after he came back from South Africa, and I'm like, what happened? And, you know, he's all twisted up, and like, he doesn't want to talk about it, but he's like, you've seen this before, like... When Martin Lawrence got a big check and he freaked out. When Mariah Carey got a big check and freaked out. Like, do you not see the pattern?
But do you talk about that on this show, what success means and how it isn't always the most wonderful thing that happened to a person?
You know, we have not... I have tried to discuss success as a broad thing, right? It's not about money. It's not about awards. You know, Nikki Giovanni was the third guest I had, not traditionally successful, but extraordinarily successful. But no, I have not gotten to the pitfalls of success or whatever, or where it's not working or, I mean, is that a big...
No, I just think it's very interesting. The Chappelle case is very interesting because it's so anti-American in spirit, right? Because the American principle is more money, better. But more money, more problems, which is an interesting kind of moral thread in hip-hop, which I love about hip-hop. And it's very rarely, you know, when you're hearing criticism about hip-hop, nobody ever mentions that. The hip-hop is full of the discussion of the problematic of money. What do you do with it? Who do you give it to? Does your mama need it? Does your whole family need it? How big is your crew? What does it mean when you have it? You have to move out together.
Does that girl you like need it?
Right. It's always about that in a way that the rest of American culture is pretty silent on the topic of what money is meant to mean. And so when Chappelle checked out, he's absolutely right. It's a long tradition of people asking themselves, what does the check mean in relation to the work? And the answer is always that the check is absurd. There is no price tag for, Ode to a Nightingale. It can be worth $1. It could be worth $40 million. It doesn't. The money is insane when it's attached to art. It doesn't actually make any sense. Can't make any sense. If it's a reasonable fee, one can rationalize it, you know, and think of hours done and work done.
I mean, one thing for me as a writer is that I always took all my opportunities super seriously.
Right.
And out of the group of like New York hip hop writers who came in the early 90s, I was sort of like considered like the nerd. Like he always turns his stories in on time. Right. He doesn't turn them in like 1,000 words over the limit. Like he knows the limit. He knows the deadline. Like he's such a nerd, right? We're rock stars. We show up a week late or 2 weeks late. Right. I'm like, guys, you can't make a career out of showing up late all the time. But I didn't think that opportunity would just abound, especially for a black artist. Right. And to see Dave walk away from $40, $50 million with Chappelle's show, like, hurt me because, like, how many times in life does a black artist get that sort of opportunity? And he had that faith in himself, and he could not have seen the coming of Netflix.
No.
But he was able to make that up and then some, and it's amazing.
I think most of us have never been brave enough to do it, but when people do things like that, there was a case in England of a kind of proto-anarchist punk band who burnt £1 million. Do you remember in the 90s?
Whew.
Yeah. Burnt £1 million and filmed it. And they came to regret it very much because, of course, later on you could do with £1 million. It would just about buy you a house in London, maybe. But what those kind of acts do for the rest of us is release us from the idea that money is at all times everything. It's an incredible act, public act, to do because it puts into seeds in everybody's mind the idea that money can be separated from life. It doesn't have to rule every corner of life, decide every decision you make, control everything you do. That's what I thought of Chappelle, that even though I know it seems insane, it was an act of freedom, symbolic freedom.
Yeah.
And that freedom is passed on to all the people who witness it. Even the ones who say, you're crazy, are you kidding? I'm suffering from paycheck to paycheck, you just turned back 15 million. But even those people, I think there's a little seed of joy at the idea that someone has released themselves from this bind that we all seem tied by day and night.
It's almost like the old Apple commercial, right? The 1984 Apple. Like there's one woman who's got the hammer who's attacking Big Brother, but the rest of us are still sitting there.
We're just sitting there. And so, you know, acts like that will always be accused of being publicity stunts or self-regarding. But to me, it's just like little adverts for freedom almost. Like, imagine some other life. Imagine another world.
No, I would love the courage to walk away from that kind of. I feel like as I get older, I have less courage to walk away from a nice opportunity.
But the models of courage, sometimes they stay, you can't forget them. Like if you hear Muhammad Ali saying, no Viet Cong ever called me nigger.
Yeah.
That you never forget it.
Yeah.
That moment of courage lasts through, it'll last centuries because he gave up almost everything for nothing apart from to make a principled stand. These things always seem absurd at the moment, but they radiate.
I know you said you don't have a policy with nigger for your children.
Right.
But do you have it for yourself? Do you say it colloquially?
To me, it's not complicated. There are two different words. I know that maybe people roll their eyes at it, but there is one spelt with an ER and there's one spelt with an A, which is the preserve of hip-hop, which means never ignorant getting goals accomplished, or Kendrick's definition, if you prefer it, and it has West African roots. So I don't have any complication between those two words in my mind.
Yeah. So do you just say, do you say nigger, like would you say, that's
but
my nigger?
In Britain, no black relative of mine, no black friend would ever. You don't refer to yourself. You might say cuz, blood, bruv, West Indian terms, but no one in my entire youth ever said to me, hey, nigger. That never happened. It's just not a British, black British phrase. It doesn't
Brits
exist.
Brits don't do that.
Right, Brits don't do that. So for me, it's not natural, but yeah, I hear it every day in the street amongst people all the time. It doesn't, and people now say it to me, but I'm never bothered by it.
I have experienced so much love from black men through that word.
Right.
Black men don't say, I love you.
No.
Right? And I'm not talking about my father. My father was great at saying, I love you. But I'm talking about my peers and the avuncular and paternal men in my life. They don't say, I love you.
Right.
But they might say, what's up, my nigga?
Right.
And it's like, I can hear the love and I'm like, it feels so good.
And it seems to me to have intensified the past 20 years. Like, I can remember in the 80s where it's still, because it was an endless problematic in the papers. Do you remember? I mean, people constantly arguing about this.
Still,
it's still going on. But the way that hip-hop, it's as if you're reading, you know, 400 years of poetry. Certain words in it become radiant, and that word has become more and more radiant as it gets used more and more times and more context. So, yeah, but in a black British perspective, it just... I don't... I hear it a little bit in the grime now, funnily enough. You hear it more, but that's very recent.
Do you like Rick Ross?
Yeah, I do. I should.
I love Rick Ross.
I do. I can't help it. That's just... I have no reason, no defense. I just like listening
to it. Well, I mean, the music is incredible.
Is it?
His beats. He's not a great rapper, but he's sufficient.
He's sufficient.
But he would be a great A&R.
Right.
To find like the greatest beats.
He's just an amazing character. He makes me laugh. I like him. Are we okay?
Is that your phone?
Yeah, that's my phone. Yeah. Yeah. It's off. Don't worry.
Wait, no. Because you have this little tiny flip phone from like 96.
99. Yeah.
Does it text?
It does, but don't try send me any pictures or emojis.
Why do you have this little old phone?
It's the same, just time. Just, I think I'm an addictive person. I don't want to be addicted to a phone. I'm 42. I haven't got that much longer to live. I don't want to spend...
Stop it.
20% of that time looking at pictures on Instagram. I'm just not into it.
You are so good.
I know, it's boring, but I'm not into it.
Cutting yourself off from the world.
But that's not the world.
Not in a negative way. You're right. Not in a negative way. Well, but Instagram, Twitter, these are part of the world.
I know, but it's amazing how much you can catch up with just reading about in the paper or on your laptop for 10 minutes at night.
Yes, that's true.
But
you have resisted. I don't want to say it in a way that's going to put you off, but you sort of... are not engaging in these things so that you can have time for the core thing that matters to you as an artist.
But it's not, it's always defined because, to be honest, quite often when we're talking about this, I'm talking to addicts more or less.
Yeah.
They kind of construct the argument as if I have so much willpower. And it's the opposite. It's that I really am hungry for life, physical things, experiences, and the face of the person thumbing through Instagram on the subway for 2 hours. I'm not into it.
Yeah.
I'm just not into it.
Yeah.
And I can't, that's it. But I feel like I'm not going to be alone much longer. I feel things changing.
People wanting more freedom from that stuff.
Yeah.
Well,
I'll still be here when you guys want to
when you
as humans.
When you break that seeking of approval from others, then you can disengage from social media because you're trying to get the approval of folks who you never see.
I'm just like everyone. I want approval, but I want it. I want the real. I want it in reality.
Yeah.
I want it at dinner. I want it in person. I really want to. I want it for real. You know.
How come children doesn't seem to be, or let me say, how come parenting doesn't seem to drag you off course as an artist?
I don't know. Maybe I'm not that good a parent. I mean, I think Nick and I both come from backgrounds where you have a very strong sense of the good enough parent, which is a kind of it's a term from an English psychotherapist, but. Our parents were great and everything, but it wasn't like, I wouldn't say it was overdone, you know? They had their own stuff going on. You have the sense, for me, there's a definition Freud makes between acute misery, which is trauma, horror, abuse, all the rest of it, and just ordinary unhappiness. And in his mind, ordinary unhappiness is what everyone should be aiming for. And that's all I hope for with my children. Just the ordinary unhappiness that I have and that everybody has.
Ordinary unhappiness.
But the American idea where you have to like, you're like a kind of part-time circus clown, chef, full-time entertainer.
Yeah.
Your children should never be bored. They should be delighted and doing incredible activities. I'm just not, I don't see that that's an important part of childhood. I don't understand that.
God, I feel so guilty. They're not in an after-school program every afternoon. And I'm like, am I screwing up?
No. They just, and also, I saw that Norwegian writer Nausgaard in the headline somewhere yesterday say, you know, misery might have its uses in childhood. It made me a writer. And I suppose everyone who does stuff like this does think, well, what is it that happy children go on to do exactly? Do they become bankers? I don't know what they do. I mean, good for them and everything. But a little bit of misery is not the worst thing that ever happened to somebody.
You know, I thought about that when I took my kids to the Black Smithsonian in D.C. And my daughter, have you been?
No, I can't. How do you get a ticket? You have to book months ahead.
Oh, I can get you a ticket.
Oh, okay, cool.
But it was amazing. And in the bottom floor, it's chronological. It starts chronological, right, and then it goes thematic as you get higher floors. And the bottom floor, of course, is slavery and the coming here. And it's harrowing. And my daughter was 7 at the time, and she cried a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound too harsh, but I was like, good. Because I was deeply moved learning about the history of slavery as a kid. And it shaped me to say, I have to do something purposeful.
Right.
I can't just do whatever. Right. I have to have, because I'm standing on people's shoulders. Right. I would not be here if not for the sacrifices and deaths of other people. So now she's starting to see that lineage that she stands on, not just me and your grandfather, but like Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, et cetera.
But when is the right age? It is definitely the end of something. Like when you find out about the Nazis, I was about 11. I mean, I knew of them kind of, you know, in England, you always know about them because they're part of your history, but I didn't know about the concentration camps, I guess. I found out when I was 11. And I do remember that being the end of something, the end of an idea I had about the world. It was permanently done. And I wept a lot, and I was really broken by it, you know. And the experience that was twinned with that was reading Toni Morrison's The Black Book, which was a kind of imagined 300-year-old scrapbook, a commonplace book,
yeah,
kept by a black woman who would be about 300 years old. So it's from slavery onwards. Everything she would have kept, every souvenir. That was the book which had the famous photos in America, I suppose, but I'd never seen them of young black children on spits.
Spits?
Yeah, being roasted while people
sit
around eating snacks.
Yeah.
And I was about 12 when I saw that. And that was the second time I was... A certain vision of the world is dies at that point.
Mm.
Basically, that the world is benign and that people are generally kind and that war is an aberration and not... You know, you have to give that up. And I am very torn now with my children of when is the right age to bring that news.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I'm kind of impressed by my mother. She was so, and my father, they were so sure that I was ready for it or it was the right time. Because I find those decisions much harder to make.
I feel like they tell us when the right time is.
Right.
Because, you know, how much information they're taking in. When Eric Garner was going on, my son came to me and he said, you know, what does I can't breathe mean? And I started to explain it to him. He's like, well, I've seen the video. I was watching it over your shoulder. I didn't know he was paying attention. God. And so now it's like, well, we have to have this conversation.
Right.
And I don't want him to walk away like hating white people because I'm not sure he's old enough at that point to understand, you know, the entirety of it. But everybody's equal, but everybody's not treated the same.
Right.
And I think he got most of that.
But it's also slapdash. Like when I thought about having children before I had them, I imagined this stately procession of history lessons and discussion on race. And it's so random. Like it's just whatever occurs to me that day.
Right.
And then something else. And then, oh, by the way, Elvis Presley and, oh, Tupac and Malcolm X.
Right.
And just a random selection of names thrown at them. They're completely confused. most days.
Well, I didn't realize that children's attention span is extremely short. You can talk to them like in each burst for like 10 seconds. So even if you ask me a big question, I have 10 seconds to give you the, you're like, okay, you've lost me. I'm flitting off back to my toys.
Don't you have that experience with Martin Luther King Day that every year it comes around, you're able to give a little more of the story? So the first time when they were three, it was just like, he was just this wonderful man. He believed in the equality of all people. Now, 4 years later, it was out. And by the way, he was murdered. Did they tell you that in school?
By a racist white man.
It gets worse each year. Like, it's not a celebration anymore. It's just like a terrible day of misery.
Right.
Yeah. So that happens.
We'll celebrate Malcolm X Day. Just make it easier.
Oh, yeah. We had that discussion with them this year.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so that started happening.
And no, I mean, especially for the boy, I want him to know so that when he goes out in the world, he knows what he's encountering. Right. Not that the girl is not experiencing racism, but probably not risking her life walking around as early as he is.
No, it's completely different. It took me a long time to understand that. I remember doing a joint interview with my brother when he started comedy for some paper in England. And we're talking about our childhoods, and the journalists, you know, English journalists like to ask you things about if you come from an urban suburb, or they like to ask you certain questions. So they asked, you know, did you get picked up by the cops a lot? And I immediately said, no. And Ben was like, yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
And I was like, I looked at Ben and thought, oh, yeah, he had a completely different experience.
Was that not your memory?
I don't know. Maybe he didn't talk to me or he didn't tell me. He means like being stopped or being hassled or some. I didn't think about it, you know. And that's when you realize that this is a completely divergent experience that my brothers were having from me. But, I mean, that's always true of siblings, right? You think you're in it together, and then you become adults and realize that all kinds of things were not the same.
I mean, well, sure. I mean, having a girl and talking to my sister a little bit differently now, and understanding how early girls are sexualized by the grown men in the world.
Right.
Is that something that you were dealing with when you were like 12?
Well, I think I was protected by extreme frumpiness. And now that I think about it, I think it might have been a conscious decision. Like, I was reading something about anorexia somewhere recently, and the journalist who had been anorexic was explaining that for her it was about removing herself from the sexual market. She didn't want to be, and so she starved herself so that her body was outside of the whole world. And I think in my own way, by eating a lot and refusing to in any way dress nicely, or I didn't want to be part of it, you know. I wanted to be, and I was entirely left alone my entire adolescence because I just wasn't in that game. I was just not.
Purposely.
Well, I think now it must have been. If you'd asked me then, I would have been like, oh, woe is me, you know, my glasses, my braces, my crazy hair, my weight, my terrible clothes. But I think a part of it must have been subconsciously a way of staying in my child world and reading books and not being popular in that way, I think.
So in high school, you were like the nerd.
I was a total nerd. I had good friends, but I was not in the – there's a separate universe of – hot girls who were doing this and that, and I was nowhere near that world, you know. It just didn't come into my life at all.
Roxane Gay's book, Hunger.
Oh, that's a good example. Yeah, she talks about it too, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
much more extreme, version. Yeah. But I think girls, when they get to 12, can find all kinds of ways of opting out, you know. Some of them are really self-harming.
Yeah.
Anorexia being the key example. I've never been a very self-harming person, you know.
Yeah.
I'm quite addicted to pleasure. So I, even though I was sad in my adolescence, I wasn't, again, I would call it ordinary unhappiness, you know. I wasn't acutely miserable. I had my books, I had my family, I had my friends, even if they were slightly freakish. And it was fine. It was the world I wanted to be in.
But you're not ordinarily unhappy now.
No, now I am. I think I have a lot of joy. I still am. My preoccupation when I was young was death. It remains death. I can't. you know, I can't.
God, why?
Because people always say that as if it's not the only thing which is definitely going to happen to you.
Yeah, yeah.
So for that reason, I find it quite preoccupying. And so I would say it puts a limit on my, not on my pleasure, because I also think it's the only thing that makes life meaningful.
I was at a funeral on Monday.
You're going to be going to a lot more. We both are.
This is my third in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And it was like...
It's that age.
You gotta be kidding. I know, right?
Right.
In our 30s, we go to lots of weddings. In our 40s, we go to lots of funerals.
Yeah. That part, when I was a kid, I used to think, why isn't everybody running screaming through the streets given what's about to happen? Because I thought we were very death-denying of the people I knew and the culture I came from in England in the 80s and 90s. Now, I don't think death-defying even begins to cover it. Now it's like... death obliterating. Now there are people in Silicon Valley literally spending millions of dollars trying to work out a way not to die.
Right.
So that childhood mentality has spread up to the very highest echelons of government and policy. So now I really, I'm kind of amazed. And so when I'm writing, more than anything, I think of a memento mori, that writing should always, my writing anyway, has the purpose of always saying and remember death. I think it's important that people remember it. It's important so that you behave in a civilized way with others, recognizing them as beings that will die, and also that you behave reasonably in the world.
I mean, it is incredibly humbling when you really come face to face with mortality. Like,
yeah.
I know at that funeral I was at, there were people who did not like each other in life who showed up and were like hugging, smiling, let's trade numbers, let's like reconnect, because like whatever...
Right.
We bickered about 10 years ago. So does it matter.
Everything will come to nothing, literally everything you do. So for that reason, when we were talking about success earlier, to me it is defined by the completion of certain tasks, even though you know they're going to come to nothing. That's as much as I can imagine, just completing it to my own satisfaction. The inevitable.
I have an idea of the answer to this question, but it's something I ask everybody.
Right.
What is it about you personally that has led to the success that you've had?
I don't reflect on that very much. If I think about my family in general, I suppose we have a lot of willpower one way or another. That's definitely helpful. There are much brighter and brilliant talents. I come across them all the time who aren't as pig-headed as me.
Yeah. That's what I thought, hoped that you'd say. It's what I've heard, that you have this willpower that's pushing you in the right direction.
I think so. I mean, there's another kind of talent, like we're talking about Nina... where it's just genius and chaos is in its wake and everybody's weeping and the children are ruined and it's disaster and chaos everywhere you look. But there's no replacement for what someone like that has. That to me is the highest thing. I don't even aspire to that. I just want to make good work. That's it.
You see what I'm talking about? Do you see the brilliance, the fun, the cool, the humility, and yet a woman driven by an iron willpower to read and write, to protect her creative time from any and all distractions. So important and so impressive and so hard for me. To know her is to admire her. Lots of gems in this one. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Zadie, for your time and your openness. I'm on Twitter at Toure and on Instagram at Toure Show. Please stop by and say hi. And if you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review, and tell a friend who you think would like the show. Toure Show is written by me, Toure, and produced by Chris Colbert and Matt Ford, with help from Shelby Royston and in association with Cadence 13 Studios. We're beaming to you from the amazing borough of Brooklyn, baddest place in the world, and we will be back next Wednesday with more knowledge from successful folks, because the man ain't shut us down yet. Join us next Wednesday when my guest will be Susanna Melvoin, who was Prince's girlfriend before and during Purple Rain and became his fiance around Under the Cherry Moon and yet never married him. This is part of her story of the moment when Prince proposed.
He asked me in Paris, he was like, I need to talk to you. And it was, sun was coming up. It was beautiful. We were staying in the Crillon Hotel in Paris and overlooking the Arc de Triomphe. It was beautiful, beautiful. It was, sun's coming up in the morning, just barely. He wakes me up. I want to talk to you. He just looks white. I mean, just pale, pale. Are you okay? What's the matter? I need to talk to you. Okay. So we go out on the balcony, and he's taking his time. I don't really want you to be in the film. And I'm like, oh, okay. Wow. And I'm kind of look at him, and he says, I want you to be my wife. And I say, oh, what?
Hear the rest next Wednesday on Touré Show.